Okay, thank you. So this talk represents two papers. Both of them are joint with Vin Doan, who is formerly at Waterloo and is now at University of Warwick in England. And the second paper is joint with Kim, who was the previous speaker. Okay, so I'll start out trying to motivate the problem. So suppose that you are given a text corpus. So this is a collection of N text documents. You can think of sort of a collection of articles from the Globe and Mail or the New York Times or something. And then you're in this collection, you're seeking articles on some topic. So how might you proceed? So the first thing you could do is form the so-called term document matrix. So that's an M by N matrix. The rows are in correspondence with terms, terms being just words in the English language. And the columns are in correspondence with the articles, and the IJ entry is, for instance, the frequency of that particular term in that particular document. Okay, and then if you wanted to find a particular topic that maybe recurs in a number of articles, you could look for a submatrix of this data matrix that would be fairly large, so it would span a number of terms and a number of articles, and it would be approximately rank one. In other words, it could be factorized as a row vector, a column vector times a row vector. So, because you would expect that, why would that be a topic? Well, because if there's many articles about the same topic, then you would expect them to use the same terms in roughly the same proportions. So that's why the matrix would be about rank one. So a similar application is you're given an image data set. You have a sequence of images. They all have the same number of pixels, and the images are all registered with each other. In other words, the features in them are aligned. And so you form an M by N matrix where M is the number of pixels in each image and N is the number of images, and you put the intensity of pixel I in image J as the IJ entry, and then again you look for a large rank one, approximately rank one submatrix, and that corresponds to some visual feature that recurs in many of the images in your data set. Okay, so let me give you an outline of the talk. So I've now tried to motivate what we're looking for, a large approximately rank one submatrix of a matrix. It's related to the singular value decomposition. It's also related to non-negative matrix factorization, so I'll explain that a little more. Then I'll give you our convex relaxation for this problem, and I'll tell you our main theorem about when the algorithm can actually recover a feature that's in the data. Then I'll describe an algorithm, a proximal point algorithm for solving instances of this problem, and then I'll show you one of the computational experiments we did with the data set, with a data set, a real one. Okay, so first, what is the connection between this problem we're trying to solve and non-negative matrix factorization? I'll explain, well, if you don't know what non-negative matrix factorization is, it's like coming up in this transparency. Let's assume that the data matrix we start with is non-negative. So that would be the case for the two examples I gave you before, the term document matrix and the image data set. Suppose that you repeat the process I described earlier iteratively. So in other words, you find a large approximately rank one submatrix, and then you subtract it away. Okay. So you remove it from the data set, and if some of the entries would go negative, you just change those entries to zeros, okay? And then you do it again. So this would be an algorithm then to find many topics in a data set or many features in an image set. When you're all done, you would have A decomposed as a sum of these non-negative rank one matrices, approximately decomposed. And if you just put all the W's together in a matrix and all the H's together in a matrix, then you have a factorization, an approximate factorization of A as W times H transpose. So that is the non-negative matrix factorization problem. You're given a non-negative matrix A, and you want to factorize it as a product W times H, where both of these factors are non-negative, and the number of columns in H, which is equal to the number of rows in H transpose, is much smaller than the dimensions of A. So in other words, it's a low-rank approximation to the original matrix A. Mm-hmm. The algorithm I outlined earlier is called a greedy algorithm. Let me just make a few more remarks about that algorithm. First of all, the matrix that it's applied to, the original matrix A, is non-negative, and because we just stuck in that max zero thing, we know that it's going to be non-negative on all subsequent iterations. So the Perron-Frobenius theorem tells us that at least in the 2 norm and the Frobenius norm, the best approximation to a non-negative rank, a non-negative matrix, the best rank one approximation, is itself non-negative. So it's okay to assume that the WIs and the HIs are always non-negative. So then this is the definition of non-negative matrix factorization that I just gave you. And the algorithm of the kind I described earlier is called a greedy NMF algorithm, and it's been proposed several times in the literature, different kinds of greedy algorithms. But this idea of finding a feature, taking it away, and then looking for another feature, that's the greedy algorithm. Okay, so there's also a connection between the problem we're solving and the SVD. So if you're just given a matrix and you want the best rank one approximation to it, so there's a classical theorem, it goes back at least to the 1920s, that the best approximation comes from the singular value decomposition. So, but the singular value decomposition unfortunately doesn't solve our problem. So here's an example of a matrix where the SVD would solve the problem. So just take a look at this matrix for a second now. You see that the way I've constructed it, it's 4x4, and it has a 2x2 block there and another 2x2 block there, and then it has these zeros. So if you computed the singular value decomposition of that matrix, you would find that the two dominant singular vectors, there would be one that would have non-zeros in these positions, and there would be another one that would have non-zeros in these positions. So in fact, for this data matrix, the SVD would actually solve the problem. It would decompose the matrix into the singular value information would decompose the matrix into two blocks that correspond apparently to two features. But the reason that the SVD doesn't solve the problem in general is, suppose that those blocks of zeros now, suppose that they're not zeros, suppose that I put some non-zero entries there, and then I compute the SVD. Well, now for this perturbed matrix, the dominant less singular value is approximately the vector of all ones. Okay, so in other words, this SVD has now failed to identify the fact that there are two separate blocks here. So it has not found the large approximately rank one submatrix. The issue with the SVD is that it's not intended to find submatrices. It's the best rank one approximation to the whole matrix, but that's not the problem we're trying to solve. We're trying to find submatrices. Okay. So how are we going to fix that? Well, one obvious way to fix it is you just penalize the SVD by adding a term that you pay for non-zero entries. Okay. So just add a penalty term to promote sparsity. The SVD itself can be written as an optimization problem. This is, again, known from the 1920s. And so we write it here as this optimization problem, and then we add this penalty term, which I haven't said what it is yet, but something that penalizes us if U and V have a lot of non-zero entries. But this is sort of horribly non-convex. Even without this penalty term, even this first term is non-convex. Despite the fact that the SVD is an efficient algorithm, that formulation of the SVD is a non-convex optimization problem. However, it turns out that the SVD can be reposed as a convex optimization. So here's a way to do that. First of all, let's use this notation on this asterisk norm. This is the same notation that Kim used in the previous talk as notation for the nuclear norm. The nuclear norm of a matrix is defined to be the sum of its singular values. So there's a theorem about the nuclear norm that it is dual. It is the dual norm for the two norm, the operator two norm. So this is the formula for the dual of a norm. because of this duality, you can argue that the convex optimization problem of minimizing the nuclear norm of a matrix subject to this one linear inequality actually finds the dominant singular triple of A. Okay, the solution to this is going to be U1 V1 divided by sigma 1, where sigma 1, U1, V1 are the dominant singular triple of A. So now we have changed the SVD from the most sort of natural classical formulation, Eckhart-Young, to this slightly more weird formulation, but a convex formulation. Okay, so we've got the first term convexified. Now how are we going to convexify the second term, the penalty for sparsity? This is again the non-convex formulation. You could add this penalty term that penalizes non-zero entries. Before I go on to how you convexify this, let me just point out something that I guess is fairly obvious, the optimizer for this solution, the optimizer for this formulation will in fact be the dominant singular triple of a submatrix of A. So this is exactly the problem that we wish we could solve. This is a non-convex problem, but it exactly picks out a submatrix of A and then finds its dominant singular triple. Because once I and J are fixed, you see, then this penalty term doesn't matter anymore, and then you're just doing the SVD. Okay, but this problem is NP-hard. if you allow me to put a fairly general penalty function, increasing, then it's NP hard. Okay, so now we go to the convexification, which is we replace that penalty term with an L1 penalty term. So so now we take the nuclear norm plus some parameter times the one norm. This one norm is means the sum of the entries of x. Okay, so it's the vector one norm applied to stacking up the columns of x into a long vector, and so that problem is certainly convex. I'll just point out that we are not the only people in literature to use a sum of a nuclear norm plus a one norm in an optimization problem recently. So this has been used in two papers, at least on rank sparsity decomposition, one paper by Chandrasekharan et al. And the other by Candes et al. Okay, but it's for a different purpose. It's not for this purpose, for the large approximately rank one submatrix problem. Okay, so as part of our paper, we developed a bunch of results about this relaxation. Before I get to the main result, the recovery result. I'll just quickly run through some of the results that we developed. So the first observation is that this objective function, the nuclear norm of x plus theta times the one norm of x, is itself a norm. Okay, and the problem we're solving is exactly the formulation of duality of norms. Okay, so in other words, if this formulation minimized some norm of a matrix subject to A times x greater than or equals 1. That's how you formulate the dual. So in fact, our optimization problem is computing the dual of this weird norm, nuclear plus L1. And so that brings in a certain amount of theory about norm duality that's been known for a long time. So another thing that we established, we have some unfortunately fairly weak theorems in this regard, but we looked at monotonicity. So the issue is, this penalty term is supposed to penalize excessive number of non-zero entries. So you'd like to have a theorem that says that as you increase the penalty parameter, the solution x is going to get sparser. There would be some very strong kind of monotonicity theorem would be that as you increase theta, for sure the number of non-zero entries decreases. In other words, for one value of theta, the number of non-zero entries the set of non-zero entries strictly contains the set of non-zero entries for all larger values of theta. So we weren't able to prove that. We don't even think it's true. There are sort of problems of this general format for which such a strong monotonicity theorem is known, not very many. But we weren't able to prove that. But we proved some sort of weak results along those lines. One thing that you can see, it's not too hard to see, is that if theta is sufficiently large, still finite, but sufficiently large, then in fact x will just have a single entry. So it will be very sparse. It will have a non-zero entry exactly in the position of the largest entry of A. Okay, so that's fairly easy to see. So that's the kind of limiting case of monotonicity. We tried to establish some results on non-negativity. Again, we didn't quite get everything we wanted, but let me just tell you what we do know. So we intend to apply that relaxation to non-negative data matrices. So can you say anything special about the non-negative case? So in particular, the obvious question to ask is the solution x star, is that going to be non-negative? So what we were able to show is, well, if the solution is rank 1, and since we are aiming for low-rank solutions, it's not completely out of the question to ask about rank 1 solutions. If the solution is rank 1, then it's fairly easy to see that you can take it to be non-negative. Okay. If theta is 0, then the Perron-Frobenius theorem, again, says that the x star will be non-negative. If theta is strictly greater than 1, then you can make an argument based on what's happening with the one-norm term, again, to claim that the solution has to be non-negative. So, but what about that intermediate range, theta strictly greater than 0 and less than or equal to 1? We weren't able to establish it. So we left that as an open question. Okay, good. Now I'm going to get to our main result, which is recoverability. So the question, the general kind of question that people ask in this literature of recoverability is, suppose that the thing that you're looking for is actually there, okay? Will your algorithm find it? So here's the particular way we pose the problem. Well, it's still not completely particular, but this is the framework we set up. Suppose that the matrix A is constructed as a rank 1 matrix, which is sparse. In other words, many of the entries in U and V are zeros. So a sparse rank 1 matrix, and then plus noise, plus a random matrix. Then can we recover U and V? Well, okay, the answer to that is obviously no. Okay, you couldn't possibly hope to recover UNV under those assumptions, because, you know, you would always be off by some small numbers because of the presence of this random noise. So maybe we should just ask an ambitious question. Let's just ask, can we recover the support of U and the support of V, the positions of the non-zero entries? So that's the positions of the feature. So now let's specialize a little more. Let's say that the entries of R are independently identically distributed random variables, maybe Gaussian around some mean, not necessarily around zero, around some other mean. And let's assume U and V are not random. Those are two deterministic vectors, but they're sparse. So the problem, though, is still unsolvable without further hypotheses. And why is that? Well, suppose that some of the entries of U and V are positive, but they're very close to zero. Okay, then you couldn't possibly hope to find them in this setting because the signal-to-noise ratio would be too low. They would be swamped by the random matrix R. So you have to impose some further assumptions. So the next assumption we impose is that the non-zero entries of U and the non-zero entries of V have some lower bound, and that lower bound has to be related to whatever is the mean of R. So they have to sort of be above, you know, above the mean in order to compete with the noise. Okay, so here's a sort of rough statement of the main theorem on recoverability. The actual statement is quite long, and it has a bunch of technical conditions. I'll just refer you to the paper to see the actual statement. Here's the setup. So let's suppose that we have these deterministic vectors U and V. The support of U is little m, and the support of V is little n, the size of the supports. And the big matrix is big M times big N. And let's suppose that R are distributed in some according to some sub-Gaussian distribution centered around some mean mu. And let's assume furthermore that U and V satisfy all those conditions and some additional conditions. So not only do we need a lower bound, but we need an upper bound too on U and V. So that we sort of restrict their range. The penalty parameter theta has to be fairly carefully chosen for our theorem to work. And then under all those hypotheses, then the convex relaxation will recover the support of U and the support of V with probability exponentially close to 1, provided that the submatrix that you're looking for is sufficiently large. And it's not too big. It only has to be as big as the square root. M has to be as big as the square root of big M, and little n has to be as big as the square root of big N. So the matrix can be much bigger than the thing you're looking for. It can be the square of the size, and you're still able to find it, according to our theorem. Okay. Since I didn't even tell you the theorem precisely, I guess I can't tell you the proof precisely, but I'll just try to give you some of the main steps of the proof. So the first thing is, we will, just to simplify the notation for the proof, we will assume that the support of U and the support of V are in their leading indices, so that I can write everything in this nice 2x2 block form, where, you know, these are the rows that are support of U, and these are the columns that are support of V, and then I have zeros everywhere else, in as far as U and V go. So let's hypothesize that there is an optimal solution that's rank 1 and sparse. So let's suppose that the optimal X has this form, and U and V are both normalized. So then I write down the KKT conditions for being optimal for this particular convex programming problem, which, of course, as you all know, are sufficient for global optimality. So what is the KKT condition? Well, there's only one constraint, so it has a multiplier lambda. And so we have to be able to write lambda times A, that's the coefficient of the constraint, as the sum of two terms. The first term is in the subgradient of the nuclear norm. The first term is a subgradient of the nuclear norm, and the second term is a subgradient of the one norm weighted by theta. Okay, so what we're going to try to do, and this is how sort of most of these recoverability results in the literature they proceed, is they try to actually construct KKT multipliers, okay? And if they can construct them and show that they exist for the hypothesized optimal solution, then they prove that it's optimal and that the algorithm will therefore be able to find it. So what is the subgradient? What is the subdifferential of the nuclear norm, and what is the subdifferential of the one norm? Well, I won't tell you what it is in general, but I'll just tell you what it is in this special case. In the special case that I already told you, the subdifferential of y being a subgradient of x means that its dominant singular triple has exactly this form, And, oh, I didn't write this on the transparency. It's on the next one. And its norm overall has to be less than or equal to 1. Oh, no, I guess it's a consequence of this. If the dominant singular triple, if the singular value is 1, then that means the norm is 1, okay? So y has to have norm 1. That's the spectral norm. The other multiplier, z, has to have infinity norm 1. So this infinity norm, again, means the infinity norm of z changed into a vector, okay? So you concatenate the columns together. And furthermore, the 1-1 block of Z has to be the matrix of all 1s, okay? So that's the KKT condition. So now we can try to work through and figure out what all these multipliers have to be. So the first one we figure out is lambda. So for the KKT conditions to be satisfied, this algebraic equation, this is the spectral norm, this algebraic equation has to be satisfied, that lambda times A11 minus theta times the matrix of all 1s has to be equal to 1. So in our proof, I mean, that's an algebraic equation. You can't solve it in closed form. But in our proof, we're able to get good bounds on the range that lambda can be in that we need for the sort of the rest of the analysis. Okay, now once lambda is known, then we can also figure out what u bar and v bar are, because they're just the dominant singular vectors of lambda A11 minus theta times this matrix of all 1s. Now we have to go through and fill in the rest of the KKT multipliers, namely y and z. So we need to make sure that y has a two norm less than or equal to 1, and that z has infinity norm less than or equal to 1. Okay, so the requirement that y less than or equal to 1 couples the four blocks together. Oh, I made a mistake on this transparency. Sorry. So we replace it with the restriction that yij less than or equal to 1/2. That's not true for the 1-1 block. The 1-1 block, we know that its norm is 1. So the restriction on the 1-1 block is different. But for the other blocks, we just make sure that their two norm is less than or equal to 1/2, so that we can analyze the four sub-blocks of the KKT multipliers independently and construct the multipliers separately without having them coupled together. Okay, so now how do we proceed with the construction of the KKT multipliers? Y22 and Z22 are constructed, we construct them in our proof by taking Z22 to be just a multiple of the all ones matrix, and Y22 to be what's left over. So Z22 is chosen to be the mean, and Y22 is the deviation from the mean. That proof step requires a fact that maybe many of you already know. I'm not sure how well known this is, but if you make a random matrix where the entries have mean zero, and then you look at its two norm, its spectral norm, that is an unexpectedly small number. In particular, for a fixed distribution, for an n by n matrix, its two norm is on the order of square root of n. Okay, and that doesn't work for any of the other norms, and it doesn't work if the mean is not zero. But so that's a key fact that we use in the construction of the multipliers. For the blocks, the 1-2 and the 2-1 blocks, these are more complicated because we have this condition that the dominant singular triple of y has to be the one that we set in the last transparency. So that means that these other blocks can't interfere with that. And in particular, we get constraints like this, that u bar transpose times y12 has to be equal to 0. So those are it's more complicated there to construct the KKT multipliers. Basically, we set up small least squares problems, one for each column. Decoupled least squares problems, and that's how we fill in y and z for the 1-2 and the 2-1 blocks. And we need fairly good estimates of u bar and v bar to set up those least squares problems, and so then we need some results from the matrix computation literature on how singular values are perturbed when you perturb the data matrix. Okay, but that's well known. That kind of stuff has been studied by numerical analysts for 40 years, so that part is well known too. One thing that helps our analysis is, you know, usually in a convex optimization problem, you don't sort of have a lot of choice about your KKT multipliers, right? Like a linear programming dual. Well, the dual has some solution. But this is a little bit of a weird problem because both of the terms in the objective function are non-differentiable at the optimizer. I mean, in the case that we're looking for anyway. So that means that the KKT multipliers are not uniquely determined by any means. They're actually a very high dimensional space for the problem that we're trying to do. And so that means that we have some flexibility for constructing these multipliers and still coming out with a valid proof of optimality. And you know, if you haven't seen this before, here's a very trivial example of what's going on. Suppose that somebody gives you the convex problem, minimize the absolute value of x plus the absolute value of x, okay, with no constraints. So the KKT condition for that is just that the subgrade, you have to pick a subgradient of this and a subgradient of that, and they have to add up to zero. Okay, but you don't have to pick both zeros. You can in fact pick any subgradient in the interval minus 1, 1 as the subgradient for the first term, and then just pick the opposite one for the second term, and the KKT conditions are satisfied. So that's a kind of trivial example of the kind of non-uniqueness that takes place in this proof that we are using to our advantage. Okay, so that concludes my presentation of the proof. Oh, no, I just, this one more comment. So then, how do you get back U and V? Well, you don't get back U and V, you just need their supports. And the point of the theorem is that once we get the optimal X, then we just compute its own singular value decomposition, and the non-zero entries in its the two vectors of its SVD are the ones we're looking for. They're the positions of the original U and V that were used to construct the data matrix. Okay, so that's how we can recover the the feature from the matrix. This result fits into a sort of, I've made a few allusions already to the theorems about recovery that are already in the literature. So there are a lot of them nowadays. The recent literature has produced a number of examples of problems that are NP-hard, but that can be solved in polynomial time using convex relaxation under the assumption that the problem instance was formed in a particular way. Okay. Obviously, if you could do it in general, then you would be a big hero. But we can't do it in general. So, but for problem instances constructed in a certain way. So this sort of started, I guess, with the compressive sensing papers of around 2005. So these guys addressed the NP-hard problem of given an M by N matrix with linearly independent rows then given a linear system AX equals B with that matrix A, find the sparsest solution to the system of linear equations. So that problem is NP-hard, but if you make some assumptions about A, then you can show that with convex relaxation you can solve the problem in polynomial time about how A is generated. So we've done some work at Waterloo with my former student Brendan Ames on the clique and biclique problem. So in other words, if you have a graph with a clique or a biclique in it, can you find it in polynomial time with convex relaxation? And the answer is yes, if the graph is constructed a certain way. Kim Chuan-To mentioned already in his previous talk about rank minimization over an affine space. He didn't state the recovery theorem that's due to some of these authors, but and I'm not going to state it either, but basically it says that if the A and the B are constructed in a certain way, then the nuclear norm relaxation is exact. It will exactly recover the low-rank solution. Another one that's gotten a lot of publicity is the matrix completion problem, and I'll say what that is, and I'm going to get back to the matrix completion problem in a couple of transparencies, so I'll tell you what that problem is. Okay, so it turns out that our large approximately rank one submatrix can the problem it solves. I mentioned that it's NP-hard. It's not a particularly well-known NP-hard problem, but there is a better-known NP-hard problem that it can in fact solve, which is the max biclique problem. So what is the max biclique problem? So you're given as input a bipartite graph, and we define a biclique to be you take a subset of the nodes on the left and a subset of the nodes on the right, and then all the possible edges between those two two selected sets of vertices have to be present in the graph. And if that happens, that's called a biclique. So the max edge biclique problem, or just sometimes people just say the max biclique problem, asks to find the biclique with the maximum number of edges. And that problem is NP-hard. So our recovery theorem shows that, in fact, our algorithm can solve a certain planted biclique problem. So we can solve that problem, provided that that for the clique part of the graph, the left subset and the right subset are at least the square root of the number of nodes in the sets themselves. And also, then the rest of the edges have to be inserted at random. So all the rest of the edges, the ones that aren't in the clique, you have to flip a coin. It doesn't have to be 50-50. It could be just P and 1 minus P. But you have to flip a possibly biased coin for all the rest of the edges and put those edges in at random. Okay. And under those circumstances, our convex relaxation will find the biclique. So that same result was achieved in Brendan Ames and his PhD thesis. But the results are a little different. The previous result with Brendan has the advantage over this one that you don't need to know the biclique size to apply his algorithm, whereas for this relaxation, you have to correctly pick theta if you want to find the biclique. And the correct choice of theta depends on prior knowledge of the size of the biclique you're looking for. But on the other hand, the relaxation in this paper is aiming to solve a much more general problem than biclique. So I suppose it's reasonable that it when it specializes to biclique, it's not quite as powerful. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gears a little and talk about the solver that we used. So this, as I said, this problem is convex. It's not only convex, it's SDP expressible. And Kim Chuan-To actually mentioned that in his talk about how nuclear norm can be expressed as a semi-definite programming problem. But if you try to apply an SDP solver, an interior point SDP solver, then you need something like cubic flops per iteration, where P is the number of unknowns. And in this case, the number of unknowns is this matrix X, which is M by N. And that's sort of way too inefficient for large problems. So we used a subgradient descent algorithm that has been developed already by Kim Chuan-To and co-authors in the previous literature. On each step, we approximately minimize the proximal point mapping. What's the proximal point mapping? So this was also in Kim Chuan's talk, that if you have a convex function phi, you add this sort of regularizing term, lambda times x minus c, and where you use the two norm for vectors or the Frobenius norm for matrices. The Frobenius norm is just the two norm applied to the vec of the matrix. And so you have to approximately minimize this on every iteration of the algorithm. But there's a problem with that, which is that when we do this to our objective function, we get a problem that's it's still convex, but we don't know how to solve it. It's apparently as hard as the problem we started with. There doesn't seem to be any shortcut to solving, minimizing this objective. So we use this trick, and we're not the first to use this, but the trick is that we change our relaxation by duplicating the variable. So the previously the variable is x, but now we put an x1 and we take its nuclear norm, and then we take an x2 and we take its one norm, and we add a constraint that x1 has to be equal to x2. Okay, then we can do the whole proximal point framework is now applicable. Okay, because we can separately compute the proximal point mapping for the two norms individually. As Kim Chuan mentioned also in his talk, for the nuclear norm, the proximal point mapping can be written down in the solution to it can be written down in closed form. You just take the SVD of the matrix C, and then you shift all its eigenvalues by 1 over lambda towards the origin. But if they go to zero, you just take zero if they would shift to negative numbers. So for this step of the algorithm, we use Fortran routines based on the Lanczos algorithm in a package called ProPack to compute this part of the solution. Okay. So a second innovation in that paper is the termination test, and this gets back a little bit to the discussion that Kim Chuan was having with several audience members at the end of his talk this morning. So remember, the thing we're after is not actually X star, because X star doesn't carry, and well, it might, but it doesn't apparently carry much useful information in the numerical values of its entries. The thing that we care about X star is the positions of its non-zero entries. And also we want to know that it's rank one. So if we're able to determine that the optimal X is going to be rank one, and we know which positions its non-zero entries lie in at some early stage of the computation, then we could stop right then. Let's suppose that, we're going to try to design a termination test based on that point of view. So let's suppose, first of all, that we know that the optimal solution has rank one. And if that assumption fails, then the termination test I'm going to describe won't work, which means it just will never click in. So the algorithm will just run until some other default termination test takes over. And we want to test, we don't want to be like those guys with the eyeballs in the artificial intelligence community. We want our test to be rigorous, okay? So we want the test to have the property that when it says that you found the rank one solution with this sparsity pattern, that you really have found it, okay? So how can we design a test like that? So suppose we have an approximate solution. In other words, this approximate solution, you think of it as an iterate at some stage of the algorithm. A subtle point is that we actually have two iterates. We have an x1 and an x2, and it matters which one you use. But anyway, I'll skip that subtle point. So we have an approximate solution x tilde, and we compute its dominant singular triple, And we can also, we have a way to compute the Lagrange multiplier of the original problem, an approximation to it. And we want to know, do we have enough information now to guess the position of the non-zero entries? Okay, so, well, obviously, the first thing you would do is you would look for what are the big entries in U tilde versus which are the ones close to zero. Okay, so you'd, your conjecture would be, well, the big entries are the positions of the non-zeros in the solution that I'm converging to. So you make a list of that, and then you you consider this system of nonlinear equations. So these first two equations exactly express the idea that U1 and V1 are the left and right singular vectors of the matrix lambda A11 minus theta Z11, where Z11 is the matrix of all ones. And then this is a normalization constraint. So this is a square system of nonlinear equations if you could solve it, then you would exactly have those singular vectors. And these are part of the KKT conditions, not for the general case, but for the special case that it's, the solution is a rank one solution with a non-zero sparsity pattern of exactly the one that we are predicting. Okay, so you can, just given an approximate data, you can apply the Kantorovich theorem in a computational way because you can estimate all the derivatives that you need for that previous system to determine whether or not the system does have an exact solution, and if so, how far away it is from your approximate solution. Then the rest of the KKT conditions, besides those, are inequalities. Okay, so then for the inequalities, well, we have to sort of guess the rest of the multipliers. So we use some simple least squares guesses for all the rest of the multipliers. Again, taking advantage of the fact that the multipliers are not uniquely determined for this problem. And then we can check whether all the inequalities that are necessary for the KKT conditions actually hold, not at the point we have, but in the ball of radius epsilon, which is the ball that was given to us by the Kantorovich theorem. And that test is rigorous, okay? Because the Kantorovich theorem is a promise, okay? So so if that holds, then a rank one solution with the correct sparsity pattern, with the one that we're predicting from our current iterate, is known to exist then, okay? So we can stop that, and we don't have to go all the way. Let me just make a couple of remarks about this termination test. So the complexity of this technique is unknown. What do I mean by that? I mean, the kind of question that you might like to ask about this is, well, suppose that the data matrix comes from the following source, some model of generating a data matrix, then can I prove that this termination test is actually going to become active after some number of iterations that maybe depends on some condition number of something in the data, okay? So that kind of analysis seems like it might be possible for this termination test, but we haven't done it, and right now we don't know how. So we don't have any kind of complexity estimate analysis of that termination technique, but we found that in practice it can cut the iterations almost in half, at least in some cases. It's a little bit expensive to carry out because you have to solve a bunch of small least squares problems. And so we don't apply it every iteration of our algorithm. We space it out, and we apply it now and then to see if we can terminate early. Okay. Now I'll tell you what the matrix completion problem is. And I just want to make the observation that this same termination test could be used for matrix completion and possibly other problems in this literature. So the termination test itself is a sort of independent interest. What is the matrix completion problem that I've been referring to and that Kim Chuan referred to? Well, the problem is as follows. You're given a matrix M, but it has many missing entries. And the problem is to fill in those missing entries to minimize the rank of the resulting matrix that you get. Okay, so that problem is NP-hard in general. But if the missing entries, if the entries that are given satisfy a certain condition, as well as the entries that are missing, then you can solve it with convex relaxation. And so Candace and Recht, and later Candace and Tao and others, showed that the following relaxation, minimize the nuclear norm of X, subject to the constraint that X in the entries that you know, that's the set omega, equals the data that you know, then that can efficiently solve the matrix completion problem if the instance is constructed in a certain way. And our technique can be applied to this problem too, although to the best of our knowledge, nobody has done it, which is if you just have an approximate solution, you're using some iterative algorithm to get X, and you're guessing that the X that you're converging to has a certain rank, because remember, the problem here is to minimize the rank, you can get a proof from an early iterate that the rank is actually less than or equal to K, okay, by solving for multipliers. Okay, now let me just show you the result of one computational test. So we had two black and white image data sets, and I'll just show you one of them. In both cases, we ran the algorithm repeatedly to compute a partial non-negative matrix factorization, so that's the greedy application of non-negative matrix factorization. And for the termination test, we used the one on the previous transparency, and we also used the default termination test that a certain accuracy, as measured by, you know, sort of all the usual suspects, is achieved. Okay, so whenever either termination test gets satisfied, we stop. We need to choose the parameter theta. This is a little sticking point with our algorithm, so we don't really have a good way to pick theta. So we used some heuristics that we would not really like to defend in a court of law. So that's another kind of open problem. Okay, so we did apply to real data, if you can call that real data. What is the data? It's the Frey mugshot data set. And so this data set consists of 1,965 grayscale images of a particular person's face. I think this guy was a grad student. I think he was actually here at University of Toronto, named Frey. And what he did was he just set up a high-speed camera that, you know, would take one picture after another, pointing at his face. And he just, you know, kind of moved his head around and made funny faces at the camera for some period of minutes, and then he collected them all together. So there are actually 1,965 of these. This is a sampling. I just had picked 24 of them at random, just so you could see what the data set looks like. Okay. So you know, who says that graduate school isn't fun? Look at that. Now. We form the matrix that has 560 rows and 1,965 columns, one shot per column, and we look for a large rank one submatrix. As I said earlier in the talk, a feature would correspond to a subset of images with the thing we're looking for. The rank one submatrix would correspond to something that recurs in some fairly sizable subset of the images, and we apply the greedy procedure of subtracting off previous features and then running it again. Okay, so what are the results? Okay, so this is the first feature that was found. So if you look at that, you might wonder, what is that feature? See those two black spots there? So you might think that those are his eyes. That's close. They're not actually his eyes. So these are pictures. It's a shadow that's below his eyebrow. That's what it found. And so in all these pictures, the feature that's found is that he's squinting his eyes like this and making a shadow above between his eyebrows and his eyes. And the algorithm picked that up. Okay, so that was the first rank one submatrix that it found. And then here are the next two that it found. I think we found 10 rank one submatrices. This one, it's picking up something funny he did with his mouth, and then a kind of circle of black spots that are around his eye because of the way he was holding his eyes. This one picked up a black line on this side of the image because he was looking in a certain direction, and it cast a shadow on the, I guess that would be the right side of his head, okay? And so it's picking up that shadow, okay? So the algorithm, so this data set is not of the model that we analyzed in our recovery theorem. The model in our recovery theorem said there's one feature and then there's noise. So this data set has many different features, and they're all superimposed in some fairly complicated way. But this test run shows that the algorithm does have promise for finding real features in real data. And this is a semi-definite programming problem. So the number of variables, if you write it SVP, it's even more. But even if you just write it in the convex relaxation in the form that I had, the size of that matrix X, it has a million entries in it. So this is a big semi-definite programming problem, and we would not have been able to solve this with an interior point solver. Okay, so I'm going to conclude my talk with two transparencies of open questions. These are the two open questions that I already mentioned. Can we show that the optimal solution to our relaxation X is non-negative, assuming A is non-negative? It seems like it should be true. It seems like, in fact, not only should it be true, but that it should be obvious. We couldn't see it. Okay. So the issue is that, you know, the nuclear norm, if you start changing the signs of the entries, then sort of anything can happen. And we just didn't have a way to figure out what happens to the nuclear norm term if you start changing the signs of the entries. And the other open question I mentioned is that our new termination test, does it admit some kind of complexity-based analysis? We didn't try very hard to answer that, and I suspect the answer is probably yes, but we haven't tried very hard on that one yet. And here's some other open questions. So the first one is one that we're already working on, but we don't have anything to say yet, which is, can we come up with a convex relaxation that will recover multiple features at once, okay, not just one? An issue with sort of trying something fairly obvious is that most of the obvious things don't work. And the reason is that If you try to sort of recover two features at the same time, the obvious way of writing that is a semi-definite programming problem. The two fingers, the variables that encode the two features aren't distinguished from each other. Okay, but that means because it's convex that that you could exchange them or take any linear combination of them and still get a solution. And so that you don't get two features, you actually get the same feature repeated twice. I mean, basically, that's what goes wrong with all simple-minded techniques. So you need something more subtle. Okay. As I mentioned earlier, we don't for realistic data sets, we don't have a way to choose theta in a principled manner. So we're just well, I won't tell you what you do what we're doing. You can look at our paper, but it's not something we'd recommend. So the proximal point algorithm is fast compared to an interior point method, but it's not fast enough because people with NMF problems, they have the New York Times example, you're talking about tens of thousands of rows and thousands of columns. Okay, so that's a problem is too big even for the proximal point algorithm. So you need something that's much faster than what we have so far. Here's a theoretical question. This is, as I said before, this is a norm, and so it has a unit ball, and that unit ball has extreme points. So the solutions to our convex relaxation will, as you know from basic convex theory, will always be extreme points of that ball. But what are they? So we don't know. We don't have a characterization. I mean, we know what some of them are, like the rank one matrices are all extreme for that, but can we come up with a complete list of what are the extreme points for that that ball? So we don't know how to do that either. And a sort of a more general problem is that and people are finding now that you can solve these sort of matrix discovery problems by carefully designing a norm, because you design a norm. Like the reason that the nuclear norm works as a proxy for rank is because the extreme points of nuclear norm are exactly the rank one matrices. Okay, that's known already. So an optimization problem over the nuclear norm ball is going to tend to pick out those extreme points, which are the rank one matrices. So in sort of other kinds of data recovery problems, can you design a matrix norm that is tractable but has the kind of behavior that you want, where it has extreme points exactly where you need them? Okay, so that's a sort of a general open problem and kind of a new field of research. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thank you.